Good evening and welcome to Shadow Politics, an hour-long grassroots talk show which is on a mission to make America think again. We're not going to tell you how to feel. We're not going to tell you who to vote for. We're just going to bring forth the people who are making a difference in the world, because it's what's in the shadows that really changes everything. So we want you to be well-informed, because a vote is a terrible thing to waste. And to start out the new year, we've decided to do a series of candidates from the District of Columbia so that people in our hometown can have some understanding of where these people stand and what they want to do to help our community. So last week, we had Representative Dr. Oluwalawe, and tonight we have Marcus Baskin. And Marcus Baskin is running for the office of United States Senator in the District of Columbia, something I know a little bit about. And I've known Marcus just to be, you know, for transparency. I want to tell you, I've known Marcus since he was in high school. He's now, I believe he's 32. He can correct me if I'm wrong. I think he's the same age as my oldest daughter. And he's running for office. He's a great guy, and we're glad to have him on the show. Marcus, welcome.
Senator Brown, thank you for having me. I appreciate it. Great to be here.
I got to tell you, before I ask Liberty Jones to ask you some brilliant question, I have to tell you that the first time I met you, and this is a true story, I came home and I said to my wife, I just met the cutest little guy. You were in high school at the time, skinny as a rail. And I said, and someday I'll tell you, he's going to be the mayor of the District of Columbia. And I stand behind that. So I'm glad to see you running for this office. Tell us why you're doing it. Why senator?
Well, you know, one is because I stand on strong shoulders like yours, who've held this position and have stood up firmly for D.C.'s right to self-determination. But, you know, in this moment, I think there's just been an urgency. You know, I ended last year thinking about the constant attack that D.C.'s been under by the Trump administration and the Republican Congress over the last year. And I think, like all of us in positions of leadership or those who care about our communities, all of us have asked what more we can do to push back and to really finish the job, right? To make sure that D.C. gets statehood so that we're never put in this position again. And, you know, like you said, Senator, you met me when I was in high school, and since then have been organizing on the front lines for D.C. statehood. As a student organizer, I co-founded the D.C. Statehood Student Association. You know, as an elected leader, I served 6 years in office as an ANC and on the school board, but always fighting for democracy and self-determination. I've been arrested for it more times than I can count. At this point, defending D.C.'s right to self-determination. And now the stakes are just far too high for us to wait any longer. And so when thinking at the end of last year what more I could do, knowing how important the U.S. Senator role is in the fight for statehood, I knew that we could have more urgent leadership to help organize and galvanize a grassroots movement that can finally win D.C. statehood so that we get the self-determination and democracy that we deserve, and that we get the power we need in this political climate to push back on Trump's recklessness.
Well, let me first say that everything you said about organizing and standing up for statehood since you've been in high school is true, because I've been a witness to all of it in my fight. I've crossed your path many times, Marcus says. We probably only see each other at rallies and protests and potential arrests. But so everything you're saying is true. And yes, we you know, I think when you say that, I think about what Dr. King said about the urgency of now. Liberty, what do you got to say?
I have to say that I admire how much you've already achieved in the political field, because you are only 10 years older than me, which is pretty young. as a college student. And I have to ask you, you speak about justice and how important that is, self-determination and DC democracy. So we use the word justice for a lot of things, from housing to policing. And for you, what do you think is the North Star main point that would fix the most systemic problems in DC and bring justice?
Yeah, our right to self-determination, full home rule, and our right to a vote on the national stage, is really key to doing and achieving a lot of the things that you're talking about, at the hyperlocal level, and on a social level. And so, a lot of the things that we even try to advance on the local level get stymied by a national government that's not as progressive as we are in this city. And so
Well,
I think, oh, yep, go ahead.
no, you go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to
Yeah,
interrupt.
no. And so I think we have to really focus on getting our voice on the national stage. I think we underestimate how much DC could have an impact on national conversations when it comes to conversations on housing, on voting rights, and on social justice. And we've led in so many ways already with our limited home rule. And so I think our North Star is our right to self-determination. And when we do that, we can unlock possibilities for so many other things.
Well, let me just follow up and say, so what do you think is important as a strategy since you won't have a vote? This is, you understand that not only not having a vote stymies us in Congress, but it also stymies your office because a lot of people don't take the office of senator seriously. So what do you think you can do? What is your strategy to move forward if you get elected and have an impact?
Yeah, well, as you know, Senator, really the essential key to being an effective shadow senator without a vote in the Congress is both having a strong organizing muscle on the local level, being an engaged and involved leader in a grassroots effort to build support for statehood locally in the District of Columbia, galvanizing our neighbors around the statehood effort. And I've been involved in that effort for years. But I know it also means having a voice that people will listen to despite your lack of formal authority on the national stage. Both as an elected leader here in the District of Columbia, but also as a national organizer at organizations like People for the American Way, I've built the relationships around the country with young progressive leaders, with leaders on both sides of the aisle, to get things done on behalf of a broader movement, right, for democracy and for DC in particular. And I want to use that experience to leverage that voice on a national stage, to leverage those relationships, to build support for DC statehood when that time comes, but to also build consistent support for our ability to determine our local laws, for our ability to determine our own future. In every case, we know that it's just not Republicans, but also many Democrats who vote for bills, right, that curtail our local authority. And we have to have, fighters in those positions who will even stand up to our friends and say that you got to stand up for DC every time. And the first time I ever got arrested for defending DC's right to self-determination was in front of the White House of a Democratic president. So I've started by holding our friends accountable when it comes to DC statehood and self-determination, and we need folks who are willing to do that, especially in this moment.
Well, you're absolutely right about that, and you're right about organizing at the local level and consistency. You used the word consistency, and I think that's so important, because we see these things happen to the District of Columbia, and all of a sudden people get upset, and 400 or 500 people show up, and they think that's a movement. Well, that's not a movement, that's a club. And what happens is it goes away, and then it comes back, and it goes away. So consistency, I think you're right, is very important, and organizing is very important. Liberty?
Consistency is really important. I agree, but I think it's something really hard to achieve, especially with the deep polarization of the political realm overall right now. I think that a big part of that I'd like to blame technology for and social media, the spread of, clickbait politics. What do you think of that? Do you think that there is a degree of you said you were arrested under a democratic government. Do you think that there is a degree of misinformation about what self-determination means in DC?
Sure. I mean, there's definitely an education gap that still needs to be filled in the country about what self-determination and statehood would mean for the people of the District of Columbia. Some of it is an education gap. Some of it, right, is partisan, is politicking. But both of those deserve some work. We've got to do the work to build the political reality for statehood, right? There's clear that Democrats have more stake in DC becoming a state than Republicans do. But we need to convince the whole country that self-determination for DC is the right thing to do. And that is true. We just got to get to more people and say it. And so we've got to do that work. But I think there's still room for a broader movement that addresses true democracy for the people of DC that just talks about this as an issue of guarding democracy, that we are front line against Trump's attack on democracy, that when he said he was going to send the National Guard into cities around the country, he started with DC, right? When he said that he was going to attack the right of governments elected by the people to govern themselves against a federal onslaught, he started by attacking local government here in DC. And so there's key messaging right now that we can use, but also a key moment that we can take advantage of. There are more people who are aware of the DC statehood fight and our lack of self-determination than there ever have been before. What we need now is just energetic advocates to bring that message home and get results. And obviously, there's a gap with the Trump in the White House and a Republican Congress, but when that political reality changes, which it will, we need DC statehood to be first on the agenda, and that means having the leaders willing to build the building blocks for that right now, both on the ground and on Capitol Hill.
Well, you mentioned your work at PFAW, great organization. I'm proud to say that they were a client of mine when I had a cons when I had my consulting firm. And I have a question for you that always baffled me. How to get the wealthy, powerful people in the District of Columbia involved in this fight? Because we often like to say that we pay the highest per capita income taxes in America, and that's true, but the reason we pay the highest per capita income taxes is that we're the richest people in America. But yet the average wealthy, even engaged person in the District of Columbia can tell you more about Hillary Clinton than they could tell you about Muriel Bowser. They can, they focus on national politics and not local politics. So how can we get these powerful people to understand that if you're willing to spend $80 million in Georgia to get Democratic senators elected, if you spent $80 million on statehood, you get two more Democrats from the district, don't you think? I mean, you would get two. I think we could, with $80 million, I think we could get statehood. And I think the first thing they would do would be to elect the people of the District of Columbia would elect two senators. So how do you get that message across?
Yeah, I mean, the good thing, I guess the silver lining in this very difficult moment, in this very polarizing moment in the country, is that it is showing how important, DC statehood would be in these very narrow fights for justice and for democracy across the country. The fact is, the House is now about to be at a, is teetering on a majority of one or two seats. The Senate has a very narrow majority for Republicans. If DC had the power, had the voice that we deserved, if we had had it 10 years ago, which we should have, we wouldn't be in this position right now as a country. And so I think there are people who understand that and are willing to invest in that fight here. More than they would have a few years ago, because they understand, right, the stakes in making that a political reality. But I also think that people who live here, whether you're working class or affluent, now realize that all politics is local, that it does matter, what type of leadership you elect on the local level to fight against a federal onslaught of our home rule, but it also matters what type of Congress you elect, who are hyper focused on the statehood issue. And that means, right, investing in not just any Democrat running for federal office, but investing in those Democrats that are committed to the DC statehood fight and to our self-determination in every instance. But it also means but it also means, committing to building that grassroots effort for statehood to make it a political reality and make it the political will here on the ground. And I think that there are more people engaged in that fight now than there ever before, than there ever have been before. Shout out to the organizers of Free DC, who are really building a grassroots movement that are consistently on the Hill fighting for our self-determination, consistently on the ground fighting against encroachment to our home rule. And I think that if we invest in those grassroots efforts now, if we help build their capacity now, then we really will, it really will pay dividends in the long term. And I think more and more people are beginning to understand the real need for statehood and self-determination now more than ever.
Well, I agree with you that all politics is local, and so did one of my political mentors, Tip O'Neill. He used to say it all the time: all politics is local. Liberty, what do you got to say for yourself?
So I read online that you worked at the State Board of Education representing Ward 8 in DC. And that's really interesting to me because, likewise, I believe education is at the center of bettering things from the bottom-up approach, right? Do you see any changes that you think could be made with grassroots as you're speaking on? In terms of bettering our education systems, like what are some initiatives that people commonly don't know about that you saw that you think would be helpful?
I think from so yeah, let me just say that serving on the State Board of Education, representing Ward 8 for 4 years, has been one of the greatest honors of my career and of my life. I went to Ward 8 schools for the most part. Went to Martin Luther King Elementary School in Ward 8, graduated from Thurgood Marshall Academy in Anacostia, and so getting to represent those 40 school communities was both a honor and an education for me in terms of what more we could do on a broader level to not just impact young people's learning, but to also impact their lives, which we know has a reciprocal effect. And so, for sure, I think that there's much more that we can do to invest in our young people and make schools the center of strong communities, which is why I fought to get more investment in the community school model in DC, which not just invest in students' academic needs, but invest in the non-academic needs of students, families, and their broader communities. I think that we needed to strengthen our civics education, which I know has an impact on right our long-term fight to uphold democracy, which is why I work to help kickstart the State Board of Education's work on revising our civic education, our social studies standards, to make sure that our young people were getting a more culturally responsive and richer education on the ground. Again, been a big supporter long term of student and youth voice organizations, both as a member of the state board, but I'm an alumnus of the Marion Barry Youth Leadership Institute, which still does incredible work to uplift the voices of young people who are going to be and continue to be essential voices in the fight for DC statehood. None of these fights for voting rights or for civil rights have been successful without the voices of young people, and they continue to be important in this fight. But then there's also the fights that I hope to help wage on Capitol Hill to invest more in our young people as well, right? There are still riders in the federal budget year over year that divert money away from our public schools into voucher programs, which we know take away from private school voucher programs, which we know take away from investing in our public schools and our neighborhood schools and making them the center of school choice in our city. There's obviously the larger fight that the Trump administration is waging against the Department of Education, which we know protects the rights of our most vulnerable students in our communities, whether it's students with disabilities, young people learning English as a second language. Those fights are really important, and without a vote or not, my hope is to be a really bold voice for those rights and for those things on the national level as our senator.
Well, let me tell you that again, I agree that, first of all, correct me if I'm wrong here, Marcus, but since you went over your academic career there in Washington, D.C., didn't you receive a scholarship to college? Weren't you such a good student that you received a college
I
scholarship?
did. I was a Trachtenberg Scholar at George Washington University. Yep.
Well, you should point that out. We didn't point out your credentials, but they're substantial. Let me also say that just because this is a pet thing of mine, I dropped out of high school because my life fell apart. And the initiative that you're involved in that goes beyond the classroom is really important because people don't drop out of high school because they can't do the work. They drop out of high school
That's right.
because there's some other thing going on in their life beyond the beyond academia that needs to be dealt with. So God bless you for that. Let me ask you a practical question, Marcus. There's no salary with this job.
Yeah.
How will you survive? What do you do for a living, and will you keep doing that?
Yeah, well, I really enjoy my work right now as National Political Director at People for the American Way. And so I get to day to day help elect incredible defenders of freedom, justice, and democracy at the local level, at the state level, at the federal level, and want to continue doing that work and obviously see the work as senator. As a natural extension to the work that I've been able to do nationally, but also the work that I've had the pleasure to do both as an elected leader and as an organizer at the local level here in DC. Really see that work as a natural extension. But I know that as an even as a former ANC commissioner that Sometimes the least paid work is the most enriching. And so I'm looking forward to being DC's one of DC's advocates for statehood, and really putting myself out of work, hopefully, by achieving statehood in the short term, and really getting us the democracy that I've been organizing half my life for, and that I know you organized for. For decades, and that generations before us marched for, including Dr. King, whose birthday we're going to commemorate tomorrow. And so, this is really the unfinished work of a generation that gave us so much. And so, really looking forward to urgently helping to lead that crusade to finish the job.
Yeah, let me just point out, since tomorrow is the day that we celebrate Dr. King, a couple of things. First of all, he marched for home rule in D.C.
That's right.
People may not know that. And also, the thing that astounds me every time I think about Dr. King is that here's a man that changed the world and only lived to be 39 years old. Young people can do a lot, and that's why I have great faith in you. And I agree that your work at PFAS is kind of a natural extension. One of our problems, I can tell you from my 18 years of experience, one of our major problems in getting statehood is engaging the rest of the country, and we really need to do that. And we haven't done a very good job of it because most people, as I think you already pointed out, still need to be educated nationwide about the fact that the District of Columbia doesn't have the same rights everybody else has, because it's counterintuitive to people. Why would the seat of American democracy not practice democracy? People are generally, that don't know about this, when they find out about it, are astounded by it. So, well, it's good to know that you'll be able to survive. That's an important thing. Let me ask you also, there's an internal struggle politically on this issue. The District of Columbia has never invested much money in the fight for DC statehood. They also do not support the delegation to which you are about to try to get elected. The council, as you may remember, I got in a fight with the council when they passed criminal justice reform, not because criminal justice reform shouldn't have been dealt with, not because it's not the right for the district to decide how they want to deal with issues like this, but because they sent it up to Capitol Hill to the most conservative Congress, knowing that crime was a major campaign issue during the last campaign. And we lost 44 Democrats. For the first time in history, 44 Democrats turned against the District of Columbia. How do you deal with the fact that the city council may not be on the same track that you and the people that control the money and the power in the district may not be on the same track that you and the people that are in the Free DC movement and statehood movement? How do you deal with that? That they're not necessarily on your side.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think some people call, the senator seat being an elected lobbyist for statehood, and I don't think that just means on the federal level. I think that means being as energetic an advocate for the issue at the local level. And I'm definitely not a rare sight sighting at the Wilson Building in terms of advocating for the issues that are important to residents, and even on the issue of more fervent support for DC statehood. And so, as a shadow senator, I'll work to bring the council around to invest in more in the statehood issue. I think the current council, and I believe, however many new members of the council we get by 2027, have to realize that we can't lose our next opportunity to get DC statehood because we've seen the rawest consequence, or are beginning to see the rawest consequence of our lack of full self-determination, and we can't miss our next opportunity. So hopefully members of the council see now and will see in the future that this is a worthy investment. But if not, I'll be an advocate for it. I'll be engaged with folks like the Free DC movement to advocate for that local funding, to not just build the capacity of the delegation, but build the capacity of grassroots organizations doing the work to build, to grow their capacity, to galvanize not just our work here, but across the country. Those things have to happen. They have to be a part of the city's governance strategy. How do we get to the next stage? To the extent we can, we have to begin acting like a state and then investing in the infrastructure that's going to get us there. And I'll be an advocate to the council to make sure that's happening.
Well, and that's true. And there are issues directly related to the office and the fight for statehood that are not necessarily front and center. We were involved, the delegation was very much involved in the election of the first attorney general for the District of Columbia. And our argument and the reason for doing that is because that's what states do. They elect their attorney generals. And prior to this, if listeners don't know, the attorney general for the District of Columbia was appointed by the mayor. So we fought hard to get the first elected attorney general, and now we have our second or third. I think Brian is our second attorney general, doing a great job, by the way. Yeah, so there are a lot of issues that run around that as well. Liberty, are you still with us?
I'm here with you. I'm here. You know, both of you, it seems, have worked really hard on statehood initiatives, trying to stop forces that are rolling back local progress. So I have a question for both of you. If the two of you had to agree on one particular way that statehood is actually the silver bullet, I'm getting creative with my analogies today. But if statehood was actually the silver bullet in preventing the displacement of Native Washingtonians, what would it be? Would it be about, something like maybe controlling the tax code to protect the legacy homeowners that are being displaced? Or do you think it's something about stopping Congress, for example, from using neighborhoods as literal political playgrounds? What would you guys think?
Well, let me answer that quickly first, and then I'll let Marcus give an intelligent answer. But I'll just say that, yes, I think that we need to get them out of the business of the District of Columbia. And that's really the important th self-determination, as I think Marcus has already pointed out, really is a silver bullet because, as I'm familiar, as I often say, everything important I ever learned about politics, I learned from a popular song, and I believe God bless the child that's got his own. So that's what I say. That's the silver bullet, Marcus.
Yeah, I mean, for sure. Self-determination, I think the right to determine our own future, I think unlocks so many opportunities in so many different areas, from education to housing, to our criminal justice system that we know is, far too tied to the federal government. And I think, we've seen with this U.S. attorney, with this FBI, with this Justice Department, we've seen how volatile, folks who are real enemies to our values can be because they are so engaged in our criminal justice system. And so, I think there are many ways that, we could, on a lot of different issues, prevent kind of some of the most harmful, impacts of Native Washingtonians' conditions, negative impacts. I think we could do a lot with statehood. Just statistically, 2 billion more dollars in our budget that we would have as a state means that we could invest more boldly in housing. We can invest more boldly in public education. We can invest more equitably, right, in our neighborhoods to make sure that we're preventing displacement. But I think there's a real opportunity now, right, to unlock that potential. But I think we have to do it now because, there's an urgent need to stop that displacement, right? To stop the economic forces, to stop the social forces, to stop the political forces that are making that less possible over time. And so I think the urgency to have that leadership and to galvanize that grassroots effort has to happen now.
Let me ask you, how do you deal with there's a certain amount of cognitive dissonance that goes along with this office that for example the city council sent up a bill to let non-citizens vote in the District of Columbia in local elections. This is something that they do in certain other jurisdictions. But again, it was my humble opinion that this was crazy to send up to these people that want us invade Greenland, take over Venezuela, and keep everybody that's not from one of those nice white countries, in Northern Europe, the hell out of our country. They should know that that's going to cause us serious problems on Congress. So how do you deal with the fact that you may believe in doing something locally, but that the fight for that on Capitol Hill might set back our movement? How do you deal with something like that? I found that very hard to deal with. I got criticized a lot for saying, "Don't do this, guys." I mean, you may be right, and I agree with you, but don't do this. How do you deal with that?
So I might have, you were breaking up a little bit, Senator. I might have missed the end of your question, but I think it was about just how do you balance the like kind of the want to kind of advance our values and our right to
Yes.
self-determination to pass our own laws with kind of the strategic imperative of the political reality at the national level.
That's exactly right. Yes.
Cool. Yeah. So I think I'm a pretty absolutist in terms of, defending, the right for DC to pass, its laws and to govern itself. I think there are laws, that our city council, passes and our mayor signs that I agree with, some I don't. But I think it's our ability, it's our right, right, to pass those laws, and it's my right to hold the people that I have the opportunity to elect accountable for all of the decisions they make when election day comes around. I think, for people who I can't hold accountable or who aren't my neighbors, to then after the fact determine that, they know better than my neighbors do. I think is an infringement on our local democracy. And I just think it's plain wrong. And so I, I'm an absolutist in that fact. I think obviously we have to be strategic with maniacs, in the White House. But I don't think that that means that we should ever, temper or mute our values or leave folks who we believe should be a part of the process out of it, if we believe that that is what is right, in our community. And I think that once it's passed by our city council, once it's signed by our mayor, that we should, defend DC's right to have those laws, stay and to hold. And so, the unfortunate part is that Congress does have that right to intervene and to overturn. And so that's why, my focus is going to be squarely on making sure that they don't have that opportunity to check our paper, to check our answers after the fact. that our word will stand, and the only way we do that is through DC statehood.
Let me ask you, one of your potential adversaries, one of one of the people that will potentially run against you, is a lovely man named Roman Schneider, and he runs all the time. He's a Republican. He really is a great guy, and he's been involved in the movement for a long time. And he was on the DC committee, but when Congress had a DC committee, he was one of the people that was a staff person on that committee. In fact, the lead staff person. But his platform is all about no vote, no tax. No vote, no tax. And he bases this on the fact that Puerto Ricans only pay, they pay certain federal taxes, but they pay absolutely no income tax. So how do you deal with that? I mean, what is your feeling? Are you willing to sell your right to vote as Nelson wants you to do? He wants us to say, okay, we'll give up our rights, but we want to be compensated for it. What do you think about that approach?
I think my experience as a Washingtonian is both from growing up in a working class family, folks who always paid their fair share, who invested in their communities, who cared about their neighbors. I believe that we are a city, and our values are that we don't mind paying our fair share. We don't mind doing all the things that we've been doing for decades, paying our taxes and serving our country, and working every day to help both, our local community and our national government run. That has been a unique and lasting responsibility of Washingtonians for generations. All we want is the the reward of citizenship. We don't mind paying the dues of citizenship. We just want the rewards of citizenship, which means an equal voice in our Congress and the right to determine our own future, just like every other American. And we don't think that that's too much to ask. And so, I don't think it's ever been about not paying our fair share. It's been about having a voice, and we know that in this political climate especially, we know that the fight is not just not having some folks who pay taxes not have a voice because we just don't like how they vote sometimes. It is also how they look and the values they have and the type of communities that they uplift. Those are real fights as well, and having those voices on the national stage is worth the fight too.
Well said. Although if we eliminated personal income tax, maybe all of Trump's buddies would move into Washington, D.C., and then we'd become a state immediately. And let me just point out, if Marcus, now I'm not sure about this, Marcus, because I don't know about Senator Florence Pendleton, but you may be the first person, if elected, that's ever been a native Washingtonian that's had this job, because I come from New Jersey. Paul Strauss came from New York. Jesse Jackson came from Illinois. So you may be our first indigenous United States senator, and wouldn't that be great? Go ahead, Liberty.
So, if you were to write a Washingtonian Bill of Rights that would go into effect the moment DC becomes a state, what is the very first article that you would ensure into that bill?
Well, I think our National Bill of Rights is a pretty good blueprint. I think we would have as a state a whole lot to add to it, but I mean in terms of our first right to free speech and the right to assembly, I think is so important, right? The establishment of democracy is foundational on the right of the people to voice their agreement, to voice their dissent. And so I think we should start with that. But what I would add in terms of things that are in our, National Bill of Rights. We should have a right to housing in our community, right? We should see that as a human right in our community. We should have, we should have a strengthened right to justice. I think having an equal rights amendment in our state constitution would be incredible. That we've been led by incredible women in our present and in our past. Codifying that right, I think, would be important. So I think there's a lot we could do. Speaking of, I hope we call another statehood constitution to allow a democratic process to determine those rights as we prepare to become a state. And we'll be an advocate for that as our next senator as well. But yeah, I think establishing the right of the people to voice their opinion and determine their own future is foundational. It's what we're seeking now and what we should expect our new state to uphold as well.
Well, let me ask you, since the issue of the Constitution came up, as you well know, we had a constitutional, we drew up a constitution, which is a prerequisite to statehood. I know you're aware of it because you were part of it. And I don't know if you remember that there was a fight over whether to have a unicameral legislation or a legislature or a bicameral legislature. We chose a unicameral, which is the only other state in the country, the only other jurisdiction in the country that does that is Nebraska. And I think it's Nebraska, yeah. And we also chose to only add one more member to the legislative body that is now the city council, but would then become the, the state legislature. And that was a big fight. There were people that thought we should add a lot more people, and which would be more typical of government than to just have the kind of setup we have now. What do you think about that? Do you think if we become a state, we need to reorganize and have more people? Or do you think that we should all get together and have another constitutional convention, another convention to rewrite the last constitution and let the people decide, vote on whether to have more legislative people or not?
Yeah, I'm really in favor of having another constitutional convention. One, I think for the reason you named is I think that these are going to be tough questions about, how many chambers in our legislature we could have, how many representatives we should have. My personal opinion is more democracy the better. I definitely think we should have a larger legislature than 14. I think that that's far too small. But I think the people should decide. And so, for one, I think, it's because democracy is good. But two, I think because it builds energy towards the statehood movement. Being prepared for statehood means building a grassroots, energy for it, and envisioning what a state can be for people in people's everyday understanding. And I think having a big, broad democratic process to design that future, I don't think there's any better way to build that fervor for statehood. And so I'd be excited to see another statehood convention convened. But yeah, in terms of those questions about how large our legislature should be, yeah, my preference is the more democracy, the better.
You were on the school board. The school board gets compensated. Your office does not get compensated. How important does you do you think it is to compensate the senators?
Without, trying to give myself a pay raise before even having the job, I mean, I think, our advocates for statehood are really important in, our effort, especially now. Having folks who can have the time and the effort, I realize, the privilege that I have to be able to offer myself in this role and also be able to do work that I find meaningful and that also compensates me. Those things, there are so many people, other people in our community who want to serve who don't have that luxury to sacrifice that time. So we should, right, make it easier for people to engage in this very important work. And so, I think we should really consider compensating our statehood delegation and just investing more dollars in building the capacity of people doing this work, even, outside the delegation, folks leading grassroots efforts on the ground. I think that that's really important too.
Well, yeah, and let me just say, yeah, it's never about the money. It doesn't need to be a lot of money. It's just when you have the status of a volunteer, you'll find when you go to lobby on Capitol Hill that's the first thing Republicans say to you. So you're a volunteer, huh, Senator? Well, let our intern, Susie, who's in the ninth grade at Jackson Middle School. She'd love to talk to you, and that's the problem. It really is. So any compensation would be a good thing, I think. We're almost out of time here, so ask a great question there, Liberty.
Well,
All been incredible. Thank you.
my last question to you is, I'll start with a quote by none other than Dr. King himself. Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed. And to that, my question to you is, do you think that it's time to move beyond, lobbying and start looking at more radical and unapologetic forms of civil disobedience to demand our seats?
Well, absolutely. I mean, I think that this moment demands of all of us more urgency and to question what more we can sacrifice in the effort to secure our freedom and secure our democracy. I think that all of us who are concerned about DC's future have been asking ourselves that question constantly over the last year, which is why we've seen so many people. Right, so many more people take to the streets in protest and to organize mutual aid on behalf of their neighbors in need, whether they're folks who are unemployed because of DOGE, or there's folks who are immigrant neighbors who are being attacked by ICE. Those systems, those networks have grown in scale over the last year. And so I know we're all asking ourselves those questions, and those are in themselves more radical ways that we are pushing back against this regime. And I think, but I think we, for sure, we have to continue to raise the stakes because the stakes are high for the residents of the District of Columbia, and they get higher every day. Like I said, 4 months after my 18th birthday, I got arrested outside of the White House, pushing back against the Democratic president who was, trading the health care of women here in D.C. For the passage of a budget that was going to hurt people around the country. I believe that we all should sacrifice. I'm still committed, as I was 4 months after my 18th birthday, to that radical form of civil disobedience when the time calls for it. But I think all of us have to figure out what ways we can do that. We don't all have to be arrested, but if you're willing to go to court on someone's behalf, which people are doing, or willing to bail people out, which people are doing, or willing to spread the word and inform people about why statehood is important, inform your friends around the country. All of those things make a difference. But I think, yes, we all have to figure out what our more radical form of engagement is in this fight, and do this. And I'm grateful that my more radical form is running to be DC's next senator.
Well, I think that's a perfect place to end, I gotta tell you. And let me just say a few words about t tomorrow. Okay, Dr. King, let us all keep in mind not only what Liberty just said, but also that Dr. King said that the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. The one thing that he didn't add to that is that the rate at which it bends depends on the people that are willing to stand up and temper it. Thank you, Marcus Batcher, for being one of those people that's willing to stand up and temper it. And I hope that people out there listening will join in with Marcus. Marcus, for what it's worth, you have my endorsement. I'd love to see you get elected to this office, and I'd like to help you in any way I can. I'm not sure that you convinced Liberty to vote for you, but you know, I certainly am going to lobby for you. But thanks so much for being on our show. And tonight I'm going to leave you with the song, which we always dedicate to our guests. So this goes out to Marcus. I've chosen a song by Marvin Gaye because Marcus is a local guy and so was Marvin. But this goes out to Marcus. It goes out to Dr. King, who changed the world. And it goes out to the brave people of Minneapolis who are standing up for the rights of all of us. So we'll see you next week. Thank you, Marcus. Thank you, Liberty.
Thank you.